You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, Candy won, Candy won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Ulig, PA, and Teamsters Joint Council 56. Blake and Ulig, advocates for labor for over 40 years, proudly representing organized labor and its members throughout Missouri and Kansas. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and families in western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, Ben Tulchin, Bernie Sanders' pollster and head of Tulchin Research, will join us to discuss whether millennials who voted progressive in 2016 will continue to do so as they get older. He's got a crystal ball, I think. Then, it's the little city that could. What happened when Richmond, California, took on Chevron in a battle for control of the city? We'll talk to author Steve Early about his book, Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. In the news, Rock United sues Trump for violating the Constitution, and Missouri legislature is close to gutting the state's protections against discrimination. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights with Angie Williams, who will remind us of our First Amendment rights to protest. Now for the news. The news from our side. On Tuesday, ROC, the Restaurant Opportunity Center United, joined as a leading plaintiff in the nation's highest profile lawsuit against President Donald Trump. The suit charges Trump with violating the Emoluments Clause of the U.S. Constitution, which forbids U.S. presidents from taking gifts or, in this case, business from foreign entities. President Trump's refusal to divest from his hotels and restaurants creates an unconstitutional situation in which foreign entities are using Trump establishments to curry favor with the president. The suit was started by a coalition of lawyers who then asked ROC to join because President Trump's violation of the Emoluments Clause creates a direct competitive disadvantage for ROC's nearly 25,000 worker members, more than 200 restaurant owner members, and 3,000 consumer members, many of whom own or work in restaurants that are in the same cities as Trump hotels and restaurants. This means the loss of income and tips for ROC's worker and employer members. Saru Jayaraman, ROC executive director, told the Washington Post, "It's not a free market or a free country when foreign governments feel like they have to eat and patronize Trump hotels and restaurants because he's the president of the United States." There's been no comment on the lawsuit from the White House, but in the past, Trump's attorneys have said that the term emolument should not apply to transactions where foreign governments pay market rates for hotel rooms or banquet halls.
The Missouri House has passed House Committee Bill HCB3, legislation that would eliminate a crucial tax credit known as a circuit breaker for renters. It provides financial help to more than 100,000 Missouri seniors and people with disabilities and low incomes who rent their homes. On Wednesday, it went to the Senate and met a filibuster which brought business to a halt. When it faced opposition to Governor Eric Greitens' plan to end in-home care and nursing home services for more than 200,000 people with disabilities, the Missouri House decided to eliminate the tax credit instead to free up more than $50 million to restore to home care and nursing home programs. However, at least to the Democrats staging the filibuster, such tactics of robbing Peter to pay Paul won't work. Of course, Missouri's budget problems were neither caused by the people with disabilities nor low-income seniors, but for some reason, the governor and many legislatures think they're the ones who should pay.
Meanwhile, Senate Bill 43 is one vote away from going to Governor Eric Greitens' desk. SB 43 seeks to dismantle employment non-discrimination protections in the Missouri Human Rights Act. It was scheduled for its third reading today. On April 10th, members of Missouri Legislative Black Caucus said the bill would weaken important civil rights protections, and Minority Floor Leader Gail McCann Beatty held a press conference at which she said if Greitens signs the bill into law, it would set back anti-discrimination protections in Missouri by decades. The problems with the bill are legion, as it would enable employers to engage in unlawful discrimination with little fear of consequences by erecting unnecessary barriers to victims pursuant to their claims in court. It even seeks to eliminate individual responsibility by shielding from liability the employee or employers that engage in the act of wrongdoing. So she said, went on to say, while the bill itself is troubling, the fact that its sponsor, State Senator Gary Romine, is currently being sued for alleged unlawful discrimination under the very law he is seeking to render virtually unenforceable appears to be a blatant example of an elected official abusing his office for personal benefit. It is possible that Missouri will lose federal funding for enforcement of the Fair Housing Act if SB 43 becomes law, and that would mean a loss of 65% of the staffing at the Missouri Commission on Human Rights that enforce this crucial program.
Under Economic Policy Institute put out the following announcement this week. Republicans in Congress are offering working people a false choice between time off and money. What they're really doing is stealing overtime pay from working families. The Working Families Flexibility Act, H.R. 1180, also referred to as a comp time bill, would erode basic overtime protections for working people. The bill would allow employers to delay paying any wages for overtime worked for as long as 13 months. Most low or moderate wage working people whose paychecks are not enough would always prefer to work extra hours to receive extra pay. Under comp time, these employees give up their right to overtime earnings in exchange for promise of future time off, but with no guarantee of taking leave when they need it. This misnamed bill would result in pay cut for working people without any guaranteed flexibility or off time. Under current law, an individual who works 60 hours for 5 weeks at an hourly wage of $20 an hour would earn $7,000. 200 hours of straight time, $4,000, plus 100 hours of overtime, $3,000. Under the comp time bill, the employee lends the $3,000 of overtime pay to the employer without interest or security. The employer keeps the $3,000 until it agrees to pay it out as paid time off, or pays the money back at the end of the year. Congress is expected to take this bill up next week when they return from recess. The news tonight was read by Judy Ansel, Molly Madden, Keith Washburn, and yours truly, Michael Savoie.
many descriptions in this cruel world. As everyone knows, some are living in beautiful mansions and are wearing the finest of clothes. There are blue-blooded queens and princesses who have charms made of diamonds and pearls. But the only and thoroughbred lady is the rebel girl. She's the rebel girl, the rebel girl. To the working class, she is a shining pearl. From Maine to Georgia, you'll see her fighting for you and for me. She's right there by your side with the courage and pride. She's unequaled in this world, and I'm proud to fight for freedom. Hardened by labor, and her dress may not be so fine, but a heart in her bosom is beating that is true to her class and her kind. And the bosses in terror are trembling as her spite and defiance she'll hurl. The only and thoroughbred lady is the rebel girl. She's the rebel girl.
Hello and welcome to Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Jacob White. That song you just heard was from John McCutcheon's CD, Joe Hill's Last Will. That was The Rebel Girl. Joining me today on Heartland Labor Forum is Ben Tolchin. Ben is a political pollster and strategist who worked as the pollster for the Bernie Sanders campaign. He lives in San Francisco and is president and founder of Tolchin Research. Ben, thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
A very basic question, but tonight we're going to be talking about millennials and why millennials liked Senator Sanders' campaign, why he appealed to them. But first, I think another very simple question, but who are the millennials?
You know, it's funny. People define them between 18 and 34 years of age, but really we saw kind of a clear distinction of voters ages, 18 to 29. And we really saw a very coherent generation in that age group in all the polling we did for the Sanders campaign and other polling I've done for other clients throughout last cycle. And, what we saw was a very strong, progressive streak in them, quite frankly, on a range of issues. This wasn't just one or two issues. We just saw a consistent ideological pattern emerge among progressives. And the issues range from economics, in terms of they have a strong sense of economic justice. This is a generation that really has suffered through the Great Recession and for the better part of a decade. So for half to a third of the lives of many of the members of millennial generation, they've been suffering the effects of the Great Recession. So that's had a strong shaped their view of economics and economic policy. I mean, they really feel the fact that Wall Street, crashed the economy and no one on Wall Street was held accountable for that. Well, at the same time, the millennial generation is struggling with massive amounts of student loan debt and really bleak job prospects. So their sense of economic justice is very strong, and they feel that the wealthy should pay, you know, more and their fair share, and they aren't. And so that shapes their economic view of the world, which is, you know, very progressive and populist perspective, but also on a host of other issues, including environmental justice and climate change. They're very much for taking bold action to tackle climate change. They recognize that it's going to affect their generation more than pretty much any other generation out there, so that they directly, right? Other, you know, for older generations, it may affect, you know, their kids or grandkids, but for millennials, it may affect them themselves directly. Social justice, LGBT rights, you know, strong support for marriage equality among millennials, and that's really a non-negotiable for many of them. So you see kind of a strong left-leaning perspective on social issues. Racial justice, this is the most diverse generation in our history, in our country's history. And millennials, their view on race, I mean, they're very diverse, they're a tolerant generation. And they embrace diversity. So, you know, if elected officials running for office and don't share that worldview of embracing diversity, they're really going to have a hard time. That candidate's going to have a hard time reaching out to millennials. So we just saw a very consistent and strong progressive tendencies with this generation. It's really impressive.
And compared to, you know, there's early cultural movies that, you know, touchstones like Easy Rider or Animal House that sort of emphasize the divide that's divide within the older generation. But do you think that millennials are, is there a cultural divide like that, or are they pretty overwhelmingly progressive?
Yeah, for what we've seen, they're you know, pretty much overwhelmingly progressive. The challenge, I think, with millennials and reaching out to them is they you know, have many of them have a distrust for large institutions, and so including the Democratic Party and the Republican Party. So, you know, one reason Bernie did so well was he comes outside of the party infrastructure. I mean, he's running as a Democrat in the Democratic primary, but, you know, affiliates himself independently. And that, you know, helped him honestly do better with millennials, to have that independent streak that he had. And I think that's going to be a challenge of how do you, you know, keep millennials in the fold, in the Democratic Party fold, from the Democratic Party's perspective, when they may share the values of the Democratic Party, but they're not necessarily blindly loyal to a party or somewhat reluctant to join the party.
And that builds on social media, some different perspectives that I've been seeing about the future of the Democratic Party. And I would say that they sort of range from, you know, on the very Hillary side, you see people say, like, Bernie lost the primary by millions of votes, and so he has no right to reshape the party in his own image. And then on the other side, you see, well, you know, 95% of Democrats have a positive, you know, approach to Bernie and approve of him, and so we should adapt his agenda. So do you think coming from the Bernie campaign, do you think that the second part is more true? Do you think it's kind of in between? And can you sort of see where the Hillary supporters are coming from who have that first perspective?
Well, I look at what happened in the general election, and I look at the fact that Hillary Clinton lost the election by 78,000 votes in three key states of Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. And she lost in large part due to hemorrhaging votes with white working class voters. And many of these voters had voted for Obama in 2012 and 2008. And Bernie had a message that resonated powerfully with white working class voters. We saw that in his upset victory in Michigan, and we saw he won with the Wisconsin primary decisively, won Indiana in an upset when polling showed that he was losing, although our polling showed him ahead with only pollster and the country that had him ahead, and he won. And he did well in rural Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania was a closed primary, so kind of limited his ability to pull in these independent voters that he did so well with in Michigan and Wisconsin. And, you know, what our research and what, you know, the election results show, that Bernie did well with these white working class voters and voters in rural areas and voters with whom, quite frankly, Hillary Clinton struggled with. So our view is, you know, just having a message that can resonate with voters broadly, including millennials and white working class voters and working class voters of all ethnicities, quite frankly, you know, Bernie's message can do that. And so that's why, in my view, and those of us who work for Bernie and our collective views, that Bernie's message can help Democrats win back voters that we badly need to win back the House, to be competitive in the Senate, and to win back state houses and industrial states in the Rust Belt. So I think that at the very least, what we've been doing has gotten us in the weakest point the Democrat Party's been in almost 100 years. So our view is, well, why would we keep doing what we've been doing? And you look at the results that where they've taken us.
And coming into the campaigns, it wasn't really clear that Bernie was going to be so popular, or that his populist message was going to pick up so much. Some of the times he went from, you know, 1% to nearly coming back and winning, or to even winning. So could you just walk us through sort of what that was like for, you know, starting at the very bottom and then actually competing in a lot of states?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that, you know, the trajectory, and it was a wild ride. I mean, let's just put it that way. It was, you know, and we obviously far exceeded anyone's expectations. And the fact that he started, you know, as an asterisk in the polls, and folks I talked to in Washington, when I told them I was thinking of working for Bernie, they said, oh, that's a career ender. You know, don't do it. That's a bad idea. But I saw, based on research I had done on progressive taxes and tax on the wealthy in California and other states, as well as having worked for Howard Dean in 2004, I knew there was a potential for a progressive message in the Democratic primary. I also sensed, based on my own research and just the political moment that we were in, that Bernie's message could gain traction. Now, you know, I didn't know how far it could go, but I knew it had potential. And Bernie figured that out too. I mean, he went around doing, when he was doing his exploratory campaigns, he was testing the waters, and he started getting an audience, and social media was starting to light up, and he was starting to draw crowds. So he sensed that he had an opportunity. And again, none of us sensed how far it would go, how much support he would get. But we all kind of had the same inclination that there was an opportunity here. And obviously, Bernie had a heck of, he was just a deeply authentic candidate that really resonated with voters, particularly millennials, and they fueled his success. I mean, when we went to every state we went in, he started off with the base of support with millennials and independent men between 30 and 50. And so millennials were key to his success. And then he would eventually build on that support through him campaigning there aggressively, getting media coverage through TV ads, and then, you know, digital and field efforts. And we do better with voters 30 to 39, 40 to 49, and then eventually men over 50, particularly white men over 50 and non-college white men over 50. So that was kind of the pattern that evolved. But we just saw him just go. His trajectory was always kind of sharp line upwards. And there are some states where we just ran out of time and didn't quite close the gap. You know, Illinois, we lost by a point. Missouri, we lost by less than a point. There were half a dozen states where we got within a point. And we just, again, we're starting so far behind, but when we went in and campaigned hard, we closed the gap and gained a lot of ground. We just, every state we had to make up massive amounts of ground. At the end of the day, it's a challenge of insurgent campaign. You're coming from behind it everywhere. And ultimately, we just weren't able to catch up. But that was just being able, like Michigan was really kind of probably the highlight of the campaign, where, you know, the average polling, public polling had us down 20 points, and no one had gave us a shot, and we won, and it shocked the world, and it was one of the biggest upsets in political history and biggest come from behind victories in political history. And we just saw at that moment on, we knew that we could get more close strong and get a lot of undecideds to break our way, but that showed that we really, if we campaigned aggressively in a state, spent time and money and effort there, we could, you know, pull off an upset. And, you know, we did that in a bunch of other states too, but Michigan really was kind of the most amazing moment, because it was like, oh my gosh, no one gave us a chance of winning, and we pulled it off.
Do you think that as millennials get older, you mentioned that one of their, concern points is about being in a big institutional setting. And do you think as they get older, that's going to change and be better for the political left and progressive movement in the United States? Or do you think that as they get older and acquiesce more to the big party system and things of that nature, that their economic progressive views and maybe some of their social progressive views also will sort of fall to the wayside?
My sense, in, like having done a lot of research on millennials over the last year and a half, largely with the Bernie Sanders campaign, but also for other campaigns, is that, they are so progressive on social issues, whether it's marriage equality, whether it's pro-choice, or criminal justice issues, they're very progressive. There's strong support, legalization of marijuana, for example, that I don't see those issues, them becoming more moderate on those issues. I mean, they view gay marriage as a right. I mean, vast majorities of millennials, including Republican millennials, support gay marriage. So I don't see that, those issues, their value shifting much on social issues. And, in terms of social issues, well, those issues put them completely at odds with the modern day Republican Party, right? So they definitely much more aligned with the Democrat Party on social issues. On fiscal issues, they are definitely progressive. And I think their view of capitalism is fairly negative, quite frankly. They're down on Wall Street. They think that, Bernie's message of the rigged economy propped up by a corrupt political finance system, I think millennials really agreed with that premise. And, I think it's going to be hard to – I can't imagine their views on capitalism and the economy are going to change dramatically unless – because this generation is starting off so far behind in terms of student debt, not being able to afford a house, not being able to do, basically the big concern is this generation is at real peril for not being better off than their parents' generation. And that questions the entire American dream and the premise of America, right, in terms of aspirational goals, being better off than our parents or grandparents. And they are starting, their economic lives so far behind the ball. I can't imagine that they all of a sudden become largely in favor of a Republican supply-side economic agenda of tax cuts for the wealthy. I just don't see that happening anytime soon. So I think on economic issues, I think they're going to be pretty progressive. I mean, some may waver over time as they accrue some wealth or own a house and pay more in taxes, but given where they're starting from, they're going to have a lot of student loan debt for a long time. I have a hard time seeing that they're going to start embracing the ways of the Republican Party that believes in tax cuts for the rich and deregulating Wall Street.
We've been talking with Ben Tolchin. He's the president and founder of Tolchin Research. He lives in San Francisco, and he was the pollster for Bernie Sanders' presidential campaign in 2016. Ben, thank you so much for joining us. Is there any last words you want to part us with or let us know where we could follow some more of your work?
Yeah, sure. I appreciate the opportunity to be on your show. Feel free to follow me either on Twitter or Facebook. Tolchin Research is the name of the company, or my website, tolchinresearch.com. And, the big thing to look out for is the debate within the Democratic Party of whether Democrats embrace Bernie's progressive economic message or not, and that's a real debate that's going on within the party right now, so stay tuned on that.
All right. Again, this has been Ben Tolchin. I'm Jacob White. You are listening to Heartland Labor Forum, and thank you very much.
Collaborations Live at Folly Theater, a night of innovative original music, film, and dance, June 30th, 8 p.m. VIP options earlier in the evening. All of the following artists will be performing for your amazement: Quixotic and Calvin Arsenia, Kelly Hunt and Jeff Black, Enrique Chi of Making Movies and Art as Mentorship Students and UMKC Conservatory Students, Amado Espinoza and Hot Club of KC, Barclay Martin and Julia Hale, A La Mode and Burlesque Downtown Underground, State City Films and Rita Chiarelli, and Ensemble Iberica and Elks Pride Pictures. These collaborative efforts will be live on the stage of the Folly Theater on June 30th, beginning at 8 p.m. These tickets are on sale right now at the ticket link found at kkfi.org/events or at the Folly box office. For collaborations live at Folly Theater on June 30th, kkfi.org/events.
Hi, this is Kim Claus with the Heartland Labor Forum. I recently read a book called Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City by Steve Early. Steve Early has been an organizer, lawyer, union representative, and labor activist for the past 45 years. He is the author of three other books, including Save Our Unions, Dispatches from a Movement in Distress. I was able to catch up with Steve last week to talk to him about his latest book. Steve Early, welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Let's set the stage a little bit. Refinery Town takes place in Richmond, California. Can you just tell us a little bit about Richmond, like how big it is, where it's located, its history with big oil and stuff like that?
Well, Richmond is located just across the San Francisco Bay from San Francisco, up the coast of the East Bay from the better known cities of Oakland and Berkeley. And it has been an industrial city for more than 110 years. It grew up originally around the site of a Standard Oil refinery that still operates today, producing oil and other petroleum products for millions of California drivers. The refinery is operated by Chevron, the energy company, one of the biggest oil producers in the world. And Chevron, to this day, is the largest taxpayer, largest employer in the city, largest philanthropist, and for a long time was a dominant influence in municipal politics.
Yeah, I think you used the word corporate paternalism, right?
Well, I think one aspect of a traditional company town, and that's what Richmond was for much of the 20th century, is a domination of all aspects of community life. In the book Refinery Town, I look at some of the history of the company and how it developed here and elsewhere. And Standard Oil was a big union buster. It was fiercely resistant to industrial worker organizing in the oil industry for many decades. Took a long time for the oil workers to finally organize the Chevron, what's now the Chevron refinery here in Richmond. Wasn't organized until 1950. And part of the company's very sophisticated strategy for remaining union-free was to support a company union for many years, to be a big philanthropist in the community and be very skillful at dividing its own workforce against the community when needed, and keeping the workers divided among themselves.
Yep, divide and conquer. How and when did you come to live in Richmond?
I moved to Richmond 5 years ago after working for more than 30 years in the Northeast as a Boston-based national union representative for the Communication Workers of America. A union represents workers in both the private and the public sector. So I'd been involved for many years in union contract negotiations and organizing and strike activity. Had also done freelance journalism on the side. Refinery Town is my fourth book. The three previous ones all dealt with labor issues primarily. And this one deals with a broader range of questions, I think, of interest to people trying to remake cities in any part of the country.
So can you talk a little bit about the Richmond Progressive Alliance, the RPA, as they are called, and kind of what their goals have been?
Well, about 15 years ago, a fairly disparate group of activists came together to try to figure out ways to wrest control of City Hall away from the conservative, business-dominated coalition led by Chevron. The ruling establishment of the city at that time included not only Big Oil, but the Manufacturers Association, the Chamber of Commerce, conservative building trades unions, and the police and firefighters. The opposition that emerged under the banner of what's called today the Richmond Progressive Alliance was formed by members of the California Green Party, people who were active trade unionists, dissident Latino and African-American Democrats, some independents and socialists of varying stripes. And they had been involved in single-issue campaigns about homelessness and housing affordability, about police brutality, about various labor and environmental issues, and decided that they needed to run some progressives from these different movements for city council so that they would have more influence within city government and begin to move the city in a different direction.
Do you think that they had any idea at all in the beginning, like 15 years ago, that they would be so successful in going up against a giant like Chevron?
I think people realized that it was going to be an uphill fight. The Richmond Progressive Alliance first ran candidates for municipal office in 2004. Only one of its two candidates won, Gail McLaughlin, who 2 years later went on to win an upset election victory and helped make Richmond over the next 8 years the largest city in the country with a green mayor. Gail is still on the city council today, but unlike 12 years ago, rather than being the lone standard bearer for the progressive movement, she's now part of a progressive supermajority, 5 out of 7 members of the city council in this city of 110,000 people. And over the last 12 years, as a result of patient and persistent and effective grassroots electoral movement building, progressive candidates here have won 10 out of 16 city council or mayoral races, notwithstanding having big business special interests like Big Oil, Big Soda, the landlord lobby spend millions of dollars trying to defeat these candidates.
And they did all of that with grassroots organizing and, like you just said, a lot less money.
The RPA has relied on hundreds of volunteers, people who get out and do door-to-door canvassing, not only in election years, but year-round on behalf of various causes and campaigns, most recently for rent control in Richmond. The RPA success, I think, is attributable to it being a hybrid organization. It doesn't just pop up at election time running candidates. It functions as a membership organization, a community labor coalition, and a year-round multi-issue organizing center. Its candidates all refuse, in Bernie Sanders-style, corporate contributions, so that becomes a big line of demarcation between them and the mainly corporate Democrats that they run against. And progressive candidates in Richmond run as part of teams or slates. They coordinate their electoral activity. And as I said, they tie it into issues of concern to the majority of people in the poor and working class city. Last fall, after 12 years of work, advocates of rent control got a rent regulation ordinance on the ballot. The referendum vote in favor was 2-1. And in addition to electing two more progressive candidates who favored rent control, about 10,000 units in Richmond are now covered by this new ordinance. Rents were rolled back to the level of a year ago. Future rent increases are limited to the overall cost of living increases. We have a rent board, and we also have a broader requirement that landlords cannot evict tenants without just cause. So this really is the culmination of more than a decade of work around the issue of housing affordability in the city.
Well, and that's great. And like you said, you do it year-round and every year, not just during election times. If you're just tuning in, this is Kim Claus with the Heartland Labor Forum, and today I'm speaking with Steve Early, author of Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City on KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station. So community organizing is a lot like union organizing, and I imagine it's even more so in a place like Richmond with its, you know, close ties to this big corporation. Is that correct?
Yeah, I think there's an overlap between community and labor issues here. There was a successful campaign, for example, to raise the local minimum wage that involved both low-income people in the community who were, for the most part, not union members, but active in a group called the Alliance of Californians for Community Empowerment, a successor to the old community organization known as ACORN. And ACE is affiliated with the Richmond Progressive Alliance. It's part of its electoral coalition. But the push for raising the minimum wage, the push for rent control, the push for police accountability has also been supported by other unions in the city, the California Nurses Association, which represents several hundred nurses at a Kaiser hospital in downtown Richmond. We've gotten support from the Transit Workers Union that represents BART employees, the Bay Area Rapid Transit System. The National Union of Healthcare Workers has members in Richmond and has supported the progressive movement. And the Service Employees Local, which represents Richmond City Hall workers, both white-collar and blue-collar, have all been part of the progressive coalition here and very active in supporting RPA candidates.
And Richmond is really not that big of a city, but the municipal elections in 2014 gained all sorts of national attention. How did that happen?
In 2014, after more than a decade of challenges and efforts by Gail McLaughlin's mayoral administration to get Chevron to pay its fair share of taxes in the city and to clean up its act environmentally speaking, Chevron was determined to rid Richmond politics of progressive representatives on the council and in City Hall, and the oil company spent more than $3 million on a campaign to defeat the three-member RPA slate that year and elect a more pro-business mayor and city council members that would do Chevron's bidding. It was a case study in post-Citizens United unrestricted spending by a corporation using an independent expenditure committee, spending hundreds of thousands of dollars on negative ads, on billboards, on glossy mailings. And miraculously, the progressive candidates won, and the Chevron candidates lost. And that really was a testament to the capacity for grassroots mobilization, starting early, knocking on doors, mobilizing voters, and overcoming the malign influence of big money in politics generally and certainly locally here in Richmond.
I certainly think it's heartwarming. So the Refinery Town story is one of determination, grassroots organizing, like you said, and standing against big money. And what are the other main lessons you think are to be learned from this story?
Well, I think you know, we're a long way from overturning Citizens United and imposing limits on corporate spending in politics, getting some sort of broader system of public financing. But at the local level, one reform that has helped level the playing field is a system of local public matching funds. In Richmond, if you can, like Bernie Sanders, build up a base of small private donations, your fundraising is rewarded up to a cap by thousands of dollars in public matching funds. This has been, I think, an important structural reform. A few other cities have adopted it, actually with an even more generous match in New York City and Portland, Oregon more recently. But this is an important election law reform that municipal reformers really need to pursue more aggressively if they want to wage more viable insurgent campaigns.
Absolutely, and that's exactly the right place to start is in the municipal elections.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people are getting the idea that certainly in the next 4 years, we're going to need to go local. In many states where Republicans control the governor's office of the state legislature and certainly inside the Beltway with the Trump administration, not much positive is going to happen at those levels of government. At the city level, however, it's still possible to be innovative, to experiment with progressive initiatives, to build support for them. And I think by doing that, we help build a stronger, longer-term base for the statewide and national progressive movement activity that we're going to need to change the situation in state capitals and in Washington when opportunities for that present themselves. The Richmond Progressive Alliance is part of the post-Bernie Sanders campaign network called Our Revolution. We got a lot of help from our local candidates last fall from an Our Revolution fundraising email blast. 2 years ago, Bernie came out and helped Richmond progressives when they were in their big 2014 election showdown with Chevron. So there's a close relationship here between local progressive activists and the Sanders campaign network, both before and after his inspiring 2016 Democratic presidential campaign.
That's fabulous. Well, Steve Early, we have already run out of time, so I just wanted to let you know that I really enjoyed your book, Refinery Town, Big Oil, Big Money, and the Remaking of an American City. Thanks for joining us today on the Heartland Labor Forum.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams from the law offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. So I thought I'd talk today a little bit about protesting and the First Amendment and what your rights are under both, because there are several protests coming up in the future, and we've had a lot of protests over the last few months, and I imagine that these protests will continue in the foreseeable future. So I thought I'd remind everybody a little bit about the First Amendment and the things that the First Amendment protects and does not protect. Now, as everybody may recall, the First Amendment has a whole bunch of things that it protects, but specifically related to free speech, it protects the right to free speech and the right to demonstrate. But that right isn't completely encompassing. It doesn't protect every single type of speech. For example, it doesn't protect speech where you are encouraging illegal activity, or you are encouraging imminent violence, or you are encouraging threats or harm to people or property, or you are telling lies or making libel statements about other people. However, it does include protection for speech, it includes protection for protest, and it also includes protection for speech even if that speech is controversial. So it includes protection for speech that may not be popular, and it includes protection for speech that may be even outright controversial, but it doesn't include protection for speech that includes advocating violence or criminal activity or illegal activities. So as kind of a caveat to that, when you're talking about exercising your right to protest, you can exercise that right to free speech in many different places. You can exercise your right to free speech on private property, but only if the owners of that private property give you permission to demonstrate or pass out leaflets or do your protest on their private property. Otherwise, if you're on private property, they have the right to call the police to get you ejected from that private property. If you are in public, you can
protest and exercise your right to free speech, protest and gather in public areas like streets and sidewalks, town squares, or parks, but you may have to comply with regulations such as getting permits or not blocking traffic or not blocking the flow of traffic, like, for example, on sidewalks. And if you do things that block or impede the flow of traffic on sidewalks, or you don't comply with specific permits related to protesting that your city or state or county may have, then that may be something that might get you sideways with the police or local authorities. So it's important that if you are going to participate in some of these, or if you are an organizer, that you check out these types of requirements before you start organizing. Because if you're going to need a permit, that's something that's going to have to happen usually at least several days, but sometimes several weeks or even several months prior to the protest, especially if you're going to need things like parking, or if you're going to need large spaces, or if you're going to need to rent areas, or if you're going to need to set up structures or set up like PA systems or something like that. You may have to get permission from a variety of places, including local governments, or maybe even, depending on the neighborhood you're in, you might even need to get some types of permits from even local businesses. That's not true in all situations, but that is very site specific. So if you're an organizer, you need to check out those things first. If you are organizing or protesting in small groups that isn't going to be likely to impede the flow of traffic, you more than likely are not going to have to do things like get permits prior to these things. Or if you're doing something like as an individual or just a couple of people, like pass out leaflets or something like that, you probably are not going to have to get a permit to do that. But it's always a good idea to check things out before you start doing it. The other thing that you need to also be aware of is activities like civil disobedience may not be legal, even if you were doing it peacefully. And these might include things like sit-ins or things like where you're blocking the flow of traffic in a highway or a street or on a sidewalk. All these things might, in fact, violate city ordinances or state ordinances and might, in fact, get you in trouble with the law and get you arrested, even if you're participating in these activities peacefully. So it's a good idea to, if you are deciding whether or not to participate in something like this, talk with a lawyer before you decide to do something like this, because you may in fact be arrested. And just because you are participating in something peacefully, it may in fact be an unlawful situation and may in fact impact your criminal history. That's something that you need to take into account before you decide to do that. Other issues related to free speech includes things like, do you have the right to heckle people if you're in a situation where you're listening to someone that you don't agree with? Generally, you can heckle people. You may be ejected from the venue, but you do generally have a right to exercise those free speech. Something else that you also need to be aware of is sometimes police or communities or cities have the right to set up protest zones or areas where they have protesters so they can stand in a specific place. This might be true especially in a situation where they feel like there might be specific threats or there might be a likelihood of violence. And sometimes they even do things like search people as they're going into those specific areas. You obviously have the right to refuse to have your bags and your person searched, but that also means that they may have the right to refuse that you enter that area. So those are all things to be consider when you are deciding whether or not to participate in a protest. When you are protesting, you have the right to film police officers while they are watching you protest, and you need to also be aware that police can legally go into protest activities in plain clothes and hang around and listen to what's happening. Most of the time, if a protest is peaceful, police will kind of hang out on the side and watch what's going on, and that's kind of that. Sometimes things get more hairy, and that's something that you might take into consideration. We have two or three protests coming up in the near future, and probably many in the future far from that. The ACLU has many great resources on their website related to rights related to protesters, so I'd encourage you to check that out. Again, this is Angie Williams from the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Thank you so much. Be safe.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar for April 20th, 2016. People's Climate Movement Rally, Saturday, April 29th, 1 to 3 p.m. Washington Square Park, Pershing and Grand, KCMO, sponsored by Sierra Club, among others. May Day Rally in March, supporting immigrants. The Fight for 15, United We Stand in Resistance. Monday, May 1st, mobilize, 4 p.m., rally, 5 p.m., march, 6 p.m., Barney Ellis Plaza, 12th and Wyandotte. Jobs with Justice Organizing Committee meeting, Tuesday, May 2nd, 6:30, All Souls Church, 4501 Walnut. 13 Colors of a Honduran Resistance, Wednesday, May 10th, 7 p.m., Uptown Arts Bar, 3611 Broadway, KCMO. Honduran writer Melissa Cardoza and resistance singer Carla Lara on tour pay tribute to Berta Caceres and women leaders. Check out the Heartland Labor Forum schedule on heartlandlaborforum.org. You can also listen to today's show there.
Thank you, Molly, for the calendar. Tune in next week to the Heartland Labor Forum. Our show has two parts. The first is Why Boycott Driscoll's? Shucks, and it's strawberry season. And An Economy Without Immigrants. Thanks to tonight's guest engineer, Keith Washburn. And stay tuned for the Thursday night special, which is two programs from the Drug Truth Network.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.